now, immigration in the United States stirs up passionate debate on both sides of the issue, and the political debate over immigration, legal or otherwise, can sometimes be difficult to follow. All this week on Central Time, we're taking a closer look at the issues at play in the immigration debate. Today, we're looking at the laws in the United States that dictate who can settle here, how they're approved, and the hurdles in place for people who want to come to the United States. Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law and focuses on immigration and citizenship. He's also the author of two books on the subject, including Americans in Waiting and Immigration Outside the Law. Hiroshi, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of immigration in the United States and the numbers, the rough numbers of people who are coming here?
Sure. Well, in the recent years, about 1 million people have been allowed lawfully to become so-called lawful permanent residents of the United States. That's the people we think of as immigrants. And the lion's share of those folks are brought in or allowed to come in based on their family relationships. There are also people who come in to work. There are people who are coming in as refugees or getting political asylum. And there are people who come in under a lottery system that we have. It adds up to about 1 million people per year. So you can scale that against the U.S. population, which is about, 330 million right now.
And looking at charts of immigration, the raw numbers of immigrants have gone up a lot in the last few decades as compared to the past. But compared to the 1880s to 1920s, we're a little lower as a percentage of the population. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, the period that you're talking about, around the time that we think of as the heyday of Ellis Island, around 1900, give or take a decade or two. Yeah, at that time, you had a foreign-born population of the United States of about 15% of the country. It's been creeping up toward that number since about 1970, which is a modern low, and it's been creeping up to that, but it hasn't hit historic highs in terms of percentages. Of course, as you say, the absolute numbers are high because the percentage of the because the population of the United States is larger.
Talk us through the process of someone who wants to immigrate to the United States legally. And setting aside refugees and asylum seekers now, we'll be talking about that more later in the week. But I guess what we'd think of as straight-up old-fashioned moving to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the best way to think about it is that there are four basic ways to get to the United States legally in order to become what's called a lawful permanent resident. In other words, these are immigrants. I'm going to leave aside now people who come as students, come as temporary visitors, temporary workers, that kind of thing. But just focusing on people we think of as really immigrating to the country and becoming eligible to become citizens eventually, there are four basic categories. You have about 70% of the people coming in based on family relationships, which I can subdivide in a second. But just to give you an overview, there's about 12% of the immigrants are coming in based on work. About 13% of the people come in either as refugees or they get asylum in this country. And then we have a lottery that allows about 4% of the country to come in. And that adds up to your million, give or take, 100,000 or so in the last few years. And so the way it works is that someone has to file paperwork to qualify. They typically require someone to sponsor them in the sense of filing a petition for them. So let's say, for example, you're a U.S. citizen, you marry someone who's not legally in the United, not legally, let's say you marry them overseas, then that you have to petition for them, prove the relationship, and file a petition. Depending on the category, there may or may not be a waiting period. It really depends. Some of the more attenuated family relationships, like brothers and sisters, the waiting periods are over 20 years right now. It also depends on what country you're from, or I should say what country you were born in, how long you might have to wait.
Let's talk about the lottery a little bit. That's gotten some attention in the political world lately, and it sounds, I mean, the word lottery sounds like just some sort of very random process. Can you talk about the lottery portion of immigration?
Well, it is a random process in the sense it's literally a lottery. I mean, you millions of people apply, and about 50,000 people are picked every year, and they're allowed to come in. You're only allowed to apply for the lottery if you're from a country that has not sent a lot of immigrants to the United States recently. So this was originally adopted about a generation ago as a way to restore immigration from Western Europe, which had actually declined in the period from, let's say, the 1960s, 1980s. And it was really initially adopted to try to preserve some avenues for European immigration. But what's actually happened is it's become much more diverse over the last generation. A lot of African immigrants, for example, have been successful lottery applicants, winners, I suppose you could say. And so that amounts to It really amounts to just 4% of the people that we let into the country, about 50,000 a year. There's some fairly minimal education requirements, but generally speaking, this really is a lottery, and it's the lucky people who get in. But as I said, it's not every country that can apply. That is, not people from every country can apply. You have to be from only certain countries.
Hiroshi Motomura is with us from the UCLA School of Law. We're looking at immigration law in the United States, kicking off a week-long series looking at immigration-related issues. Hiroshi, let's turn for a moment to illegal immigration. Do we have a sense of, I know this is a little harder to track in terms of numbers, but the scope of illegal immigration and how much of it is what we think of, you know, people crossing the border illegally versus people, say, overstaying that student or temporary work visa?
Yeah, those are really important questions you're asking. The best estimates we have, and they're demographers that specialize in this type of estimate, because as you say, it's not as if you really can be 100% sure, but we're looking at something like 10 million people in the country, maybe 11 million people in the country who are here without lawful status. And you raise an important question about exactly how they got to be here in unlawful or illegal undocumented status. Roughly half, it's really hard to say, roughly half of them overstayed a visa after being lawfully admitted. They lawfully overstayed, and maybe up to half, it's hard to know, came across the border without being inspected. That's the technical term. So that's a significant number. I think one of the things that's interesting about this is that if you had asked me this question maybe 5-10 years ago, I would have told you that the number of people coming in illegally to the United States might be a few hundred thousand a year, and so it would be a significant percentage of people coming in legally. I think that's changed quite a bit. There's been a lot more enforcement, especially at the border. This is true not just currently, but also under the Obama administration. And so I think that the numbers have subsided somewhat, and the number of border crossings has actually dropped dramatically. And as I mentioned, this was true under Obama as well.
There's a lot of argument. One of the biggest points of debate is what happens to people who are here illegally. Is there currently a path to a permanent legal status for someone who is currently in the United States illegally?
Yeah, well, that's something that a lot of people who are in the country unlawfully are in a position to take advantage of. Let's say, for example, you are in the country, maybe you overstayed a visa, maybe you walked across the border. Let's say you marry a U.S. citizen. Then you'd qualify as a spouse of a U.S. citizen. You qualify to get a green card, and some years later, you'd qualify to become a U.S. citizen, or you'd be eligible to naturalize. Can you do that? There are other hurdles besides just being qualified by virtue of marriage. You have to have your sponsor, who'd be your husband or wife, file an affidavit guaranteeing financial support, for example. And it's not always clear that you'll be able to actually qualify to get a green card. You get some really strange complications here, but not everyone who's in the United States unlawfully marries a U.S. citizen can stay in the country and get a green card. Some people are not eligible to do that without leaving the country. Once they leave the country, they may not be able to come back for 3 years or possibly for 10 years. So I'm just scratching the surface of some complications here. But the bottom line is, yes, you can. There's a lot of people who marry U.S. citizens and are able to legalize their status. But a lot of people, for various technical reasons, cannot.
A huge question that we could spend a whole segment on, I'll just ask it to you in one question. There's a lot of debate over the economic impact of legal and illegal immigrants, their impact on jobs for people who are already citizens. Some people making the case that we need more immigrants to do a lot of the jobs with an aging population. Big picture, do you have a sense of the economic impact?
Well, you know, this is a really important question, and it's complicated enough that economists have built careers on this question. But I think it really comes down to this. There's a lot of, I think, a consensus that if you look at the economy as a whole, it helps quite a bit to have immigrants because they help grow the economy in terms of allowing enterprises to stay in the United States. They create demand for goods and services. The difficulty is that the winners or the gains from immigration are not necessarily evenly spread out. And so there are going to be some, there might be a lot of people who are much better off economically, including keeping their jobs because they're immigrants coming in. But there might be a few people who are going to be displaced and are going to suffer. And so a lot of the challenge, I think, for policymakers is to try to take those gains that you see across the economy and the country as a whole and to channel those to people, to whether it's job retraining or educational access, to those who are going to be hurt in some way. I think overall the people hurt are not as numerous as the people who are helped, but I don't mean to diminish the hardship that it can cause. It's also true in terms of tax revenues because it, as a general matter, you've got a lot of federal revenues coming in on the basis of people working without papers, but they're paying the Social Security, they're getting income tax withheld. They may not get that back. That's a net gain for the federal government, but there are localities around the country that may have higher educational costs, for example, and they're not necessarily getting that fully compensated by the federal government. So the bottom line is immigration helps economically, but I think the country as a policy matter has challenges to try to spread the wealth to make sure that we reduce the number of people who lose out.
We're talking to Hiroshi Motomura right now, professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship. He's with us today to give us a quick lesson in immigration laws here in the United States. And we're taking your questions. If you have one, call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What question do you have about immigration and immigration law as it currently stands in the United States? What do you find confusing about the laws? What do you want to know more about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation about immigration law in the United States with Hiroshi Motomura. He is a professor at the UCLA School of Law. He focuses on immigration and citizenship issues. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. What is confusing to you about immigration laws and policies here in the United States? Is there something you could use some clarification on, a question that has been nagging at you, maybe based on what you've seen in the news or heard on this show? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Owen is with us in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hey, good afternoon, Rob. Thanks a lot for taking my call today. And so as a beginning young dairy farmer here in Wisconsin, I'm competing against these large economic model dairy farms that believe in an economy as a scale, but 90% of their workforce is not eligible to vote. Now, some of those might be H-2A work visas, some of them might be using the H-2C work visas, and some of them might not be legal at all for different reasons, like the guest spoke about earlier. So the question that I have is, because these people aren't voters, what is that doing to the representation of the farming community here in this country when people like me are trying to operate in a manner that's legal and competing against people who don't have legal citizens who can't vote, creating their wealth for them?
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. A lot there. First, can you talk about those couple categories of legal work, work visas, Hiroshi, that would allow people to come in and work on the dairy farms legally?
Yeah, sure. When you asked earlier about who's allowed to come in, I was focusing on people who come in to be immigrants in the sense to become eligible for citizenship a few years down the road. As the caller says, he's absolutely right, that there are different categories for people to come in legally to work on a temporary basis. And some of them are agricultural, some are not agricultural. There are a lot of people coming in IT, computer fields. Those categories are significant. And the caller's right that these are people who are not allowed to vote. I mean, one thing I should say is that, you know, the people living, let's say you're foreign born in your country, you could be here temporarily. You certainly wouldn't be allowed to vote. with a few exceptions around the country. If you're here as a green card holder, you're not allowed to vote. That a green card holder is the permanent resident. It's only when you become a citizen that you're allowed to vote. And so there is this sense that in some communities, you've got a lot of people living without being able to exercise, they don't have the right to vote. This is true throughout the country. I guess it's true in the farming communities that your caller's talking about. It's also true, certainly, in a lot of large cities.
Owen also mentioned his concerns about non-legal workers, in this case at dairy farmers. What kind of enforcement and laws are there for employers?
Well, it's been illegal since 1986 for U.S. employers to hire or to continue to hire people who are not authorized to work. And so you have people, there's a process that anyone's gone through in this country if they've gotten any new job since 1986, filling out paperwork. The tricky thing about this is that when Congress adopted this in 1986, they created a system that was actually pretty easy to get around in certain ways. There are a lot of false documents floating around out there. And so that's a lot of what I think the call is referring to with regard to people working when they shouldn't be. But, you know, if the part of the policy angle of this is that throughout the history of the United States, certainly in the history of the entire 20th century, the U.S. economy has really had what seems to be an insatiable thirst for workers, whether they're in the country legally or not. And so there's been a lot of times in U.S. history throughout the whole 20th century when Congress has decided that we're going to make it look like it's hard to work illegally, but in fact, we're going to create a system where there's a lot of looking the other way. And that's quite a bit of how we got to the mess we're in now, where we have a lot of people who are in the country unlawfully. Depends on how you kind of think about that, but certainly they've been put in a very exploited situation as well. So there's a lot of blame to go around here.
Owen, thanks for your call. We're talking about immigration and immigration law with Hiroshi Motomura from the UCLA School of Law. Back to your calls now. Karen is with us in Spooner. Karen, hi.
Hi there. Thanks so much for having this conversation today. It's really important. I heard that there was a recent ruling by the Trump administration that disallowed for people who are here illegally, like, for instance, on student visas, to remain. For instance, if a student has to go in and make a change of address moving off campus, they may go in and find themselves deported. I mean, there's so much going on right now in regards to people who are in an immigrant status that I don't know if the conversation is actually about the word immigrant anymore and is moving along to something different. I think that we are shifting the whole idea of what this is.
Karen, thanks a lot for the call. So are people, Hiroshi, maybe thinking they're here in a legal way, going in to fill out paperwork or something like that? Karen gave us an example, and finding themselves deported.
Well, a couple things that come to mind here. One is that immigration law is unbelievably complicated, and there are a lot of people who are in a gray area. And a gray area, for example, would be that someone was a student, they transferred and started school at another location without getting permission. They would be technically unlawfully in the United States at that point. But let's say they marry a U.S. citizen, like the scenario you gave earlier. So they figure, well, okay, I'm qualified to marry a U.S. citizen. That's the way you're supposed to do it. You go in. So at that point, the office, there's different possibilities here. One is that if you're going to really apply the letter of the law, the person's, as they say, out of status, and they could be subject to deportation. The other way to do it is say, look, you're in line. We're going to exercise our discretion and realize that you're going to get a green card. I think what we've seen in this administration is much more of a propensity to do the hardline approach. And so that's why you're getting some stories of people going into what they thought were fairly routine check-ins or even applying for status and then finding themselves put in a situation where they might even be put in detention at that point. So I think what you're really seeing is more of a hard line on enforcement these days, and it's coming up in some cases where before the discretion was exercised to say, you know, you're in line, you're on your way to green card status, we're going to let you do it.
Thanks a lot for that call. As we start to wrap up, Hiroshi, are there any main misconceptions about immigration that you want to set the record straight about, whether it's what we've covered so far or not?
Well, I mean, there's one thing that's within a lot of what we talked about, and that is that a lot of people, I hear often, you know, why don't they stand in line? And the fact of the matter is the system that Congress set up in the 1960s made it very difficult to come to this country to work unless you have a college degree. But the fact of the matter is that employers and just the economy really needs a lot of workers who don't have college degrees. And I hesitate to call them unskilled. They're often highly skilled. They just don't have college degrees. And so what's happened is we created a system that we sort of invite them to come here, look the other way, and then every once in a while the politics or the politicians demand heavy enforcement. I think that the misconception is that there's a line to stand in for workers without college degrees. I think one of the big things that the country needs to do is to try to align the needs of the economy with categories that will supply the labor. But at the same time, and this gets back to another thing you said, I think it's at the same time it's important to make sure that the gains to those companies from those workers are spread out and applied to things that provide some economic comfort to the people who might feel that their jobs are in jeopardy.
Hiroshi, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
Hiroshi Motomura is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, also the author of two books on the subject of immigration, Americans in Waiting and Immigration Outside the Law. He joined us with a lesson in U.S. immigration law and how it impacts who can come and stay in America. We continue our series on immigration at this time tomorrow when we look at the history of immigration in the U.S. with UW historian Cindy Ifen Cheng and find out how attitudes toward immigration and immigrants have changed over time.